Good morning and welcome to Focus on Health, the weekly radio program where we talk about all the great things happening at Van Deest Medical Center. I am your host, Lori Foster, and on today's program, we are going to get into this world of GLP-1s and talking with our nurse practitioner, Jade Williams. Before we do, I have just a couple of announcements I'd like to share. I don't really want to say that we're winding down on summer just yet, but coming to the end of the month here, we do have some sun safety events that are still coming up. Tomorrow, the 23rd of July, we're going to be at the Jewel Pool and providing some sun safety. We've got a fun activity for the kids, and we're going to be handing out free sunscreen. So we hope that you will come and join us. Bring your kids, bring your grandkids. Starting at 1 o'clock, Van Deest Medical Center will be at the Jewel Outdoor Pool. And with that, we are going to get started into our program today. As I mentioned, we're going to be talking about GLP-1s, and I'm very excited to have nurse practitioner Jade Williams joining us for today's program. Good morning and welcome, Jade.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back on the show.
Yes, thanks, guys.
Yes. So this is going to be a very interesting program. I am so looking forward to it. It is out in mainstream. People have heard of GLP-1s. Still some things kind of unknown about them. So we're going to dive in and find out if GLP-1s are really for everyone.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, should everyone be on a GLP-1?
Yes.
So for all things considered, there are like different little classes of them, but I'm just going to use it as a broad term of GLP-1. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to get into the weeds about the combos and things like that. We will talk about that specifically, that drug, but I'm just going to say GLP-1 for all things considered. So I attended a cardiovascular conference with Mayo back in April, and you know, it's a several day conference. You have multiple speakers throughout the day. You're inundated with a ton of information. But I found it so interesting that on one of the days, there was a cardiovascular provider there who did an entire topic on GLP-1s. And honestly, up to this point, I hadn't really thought about them in that light. I mean, I had started to consider and read things about how they were being touted to help women who are in menopause or the perimenopause state because they're bringing down inflammation and things like that. But I guess I hadn't really thought about it from a global perspective, the whole pathophysiology of it. And so I just felt like this all kind of brought that together. And so it was information I just would really like to share with everybody. So, you know, just kind of getting into it, should everyone be on a GLP-1? So kind of to bring it back around, we really started doing research on these in 2015, and so now we're in 2026. But 5 years ago, we were reviewing these medications more as just diabetic medications. Specifically, if you had diabetes, this might be something that you were placed on to help with management after you had been on certain other medications, kind of as a assistance along the way as your disease progressed. And then 3 years ago, we started really considering them for weight loss. We saw that at higher dosages specifically, we were having patients experience a reduction in their overall weight, which was then also providing them with other, you know, lifestyle outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so now today, there's been multiple landmark trials and outcomes from those studies where these medications are now being looked at to treat cardiometabolic disease or assisting in modifying those types of disease processes. So really today is just to talk about, should everyone be on one and what are those benefits as well as the risk and what types of conversations should you be having with your provider if it's something you're considering or had a conversation with them about. So kind of just to get into the basics of some of it, we just have to identify obesity itself is now recognized as a chronic progressive cardiometabolic disease, and it's not really a lifestyle issue. I think that's a huge pivotal shift in how we should be looking at it to begin with. We know that nearly every cardiovascular disease that primary specialist, whoever assists in management, is becomes more common when a patient is obese. And then historically, we were treating only the downstream diseases that we were seeing from that. We weren't really trying to isolate the maybe the cause or the culprit. And so now we have those therapies that are capable of altering what we would say is that upstream risk. And so this is just representing a fundamental shift in medical care in general. So as a provider, my goal is always to focus on the essential eight or life essential eight. And those are things you guys have heard me talk about multiple times, but you know, what's the quality of your diet, lipid control, your blood pressure management, sugar intake, smoking cessation, managing your weight, physical activity, and of course, sleep quality. And so what is the primary exposure that can affect all eight of those? And so really that is unfortunately what would be considered the American diet. We are heavy in ultra-processed foods, and so we also just seen a huge shift in nutrition and kind of the way that we look at that and identifying that. And for the first time, our dietary guidelines explicitly state to limit your intake of ultra-processed foods. And so there was a study in 2024 that identified the U.S. diet is made up 60 to 70% of ultra-processed foods. And so, you know, that's terrible. It's anything that has more than one ingredient. I mean, but if we're talking, that would be processed. If you're talking ultra-processed, I mean, it's when you start getting into the real lengthy ingredient list or something that's turned into something that wasn't that, you know, at its basic baseline. So if that's something, potato chips, you know, that's typically one that comes to mind. Pringles, not to call out a brand or anything of that nature, but that's a very ultra processed dietary snack. And so the goal is that if you are indulging in ultra processed foods, it's not making up the majority of your diet. But unfortunately, just with our lifestyles in general, it becomes something much easier for us to go to, right? Right. And so, unfortunately, these are more a calorically dense type of food, but typically nutritional poor. So there's a lot of calories and not a lot of actual nutrition that you're getting from these types of foods. And unfortunately, with that, it increases your risk of dysfunctional adipose tissue or things that turn into visceral fat. Okay. And so I know I'm kind of getting into it a little bit, but it just helps, I think, you'd understand a little bit better about then how these medications work.
Right. I think so too.
So if we have this visceral fat, kind of starting from the upper and moving, you know, through the situation. So not all fat cells are alike, but if we have this visceral fat, they basically, as they get larger, then they start to give off these other elements that can be considered more radical to our system. And then it increases this chronic inflammation, okay? And so this underlying chronic low-grade inflammation day in and day out, it not only impairs your glucose tolerance, but it does essentially set you up or we would call it pre-diabetes, right? Mm-hmm. If you were having issues with your insulin levels in general, but then also it's going to increase the detriments to your organ systems all the way, you know, from your tiny little blood vessels out to your actual organs. Okay. And so what can we do to help manage that? The best thing would be, how can we modify your lifestyle? And so then that's kind of how these medications have started to become into play. So if you're interested in knowing, you can always visit with your provider about two specific labs. One would be your non-fasting triglycerides, and that will identify your cardiovascular risk. They can also do a ASCVD score for you, which identifies your cardiovascular risk. And then they can also obtain a high sensitivity CRP. So two labs and then an actual number that they can kind of provide for you. And then all those can help kind of identify where then you would start to be living at with your cardiovascular disease risk. So new obesity definitions have also came out. Up to this point, we've utilized BMI, and that's probably mm-hmm. something, you know, you hear about maybe at your wellness appointment or something like that. Sometimes I feel like when it first maybe became more prevalent, we put a lot of stock into it. Now it's just kind of this accessible tool that we have available. And unfortunately, it's not super specific, right? There's limitations on really being able to evaluate the excess fat that's within the body for the patient, and it doesn't really determine whether that excess fat is contributing to disease or symptoms on the patient. So it just kind of becomes a number that we try to keep you within a range of, mm-hmm. right? And then now we're identifying this preclinical obesity and a clinical obesity, and those have kind of become hopefully the new terminology that we're using instead of necessarily putting a BMI as an actual diagnosis on your problem list, the specific number. But the preclinical obesity is really just that excess body fat, but able to function without limitations for the patient, but knowing that it increases your risk of developing cardiovascular disease as well as some cancers and type 2 diabetes. That's why it's so important, because our goal is obviously to try to prevent as best as we can those long-term chronic illnesses or early death. And then clinical obesity would be identifying symptoms that are related to the obesity and a decreased ability to conduct your daily activities due to that. So, you know, really, why do we care so much about this and identifying a patient if they have clinical obesity or starting to have health issues in regards to that? But it's because obesity is a major cardiovascular risk factor. And so those things that we're talking about specifically would be like your coronary artery disease, heart failure, hypertension, atrial fibrillation, chronic kidney disease, type 2 diabetes, and then of course premature death from a cardiovascular event. So what can we do? Or how do the GLP-1s really come into being used as a tool for our patients? Really, the goal is these are going to reduce your appetite, right? You're going to have earlier satisfaction when you're eating your meals or snacks, reducing your caloric intake. And so that's kind of the gist of it. So you're going to be consuming a smaller amount of food in general. But systemically, so what are the outward benefits of these medications doing that? It's going to reduce that chronic inflammation, decreases your visceral fat or that dysfunctional adipose tissue that I was talking about, and then decreases your blood pressure, right? It also improves the function of the endothelial lining in your vascular system, and then improves your insulin sensitivity and possible direct myocardial effects. And so kind of getting more into that, the benefits of these GLP-1s cannot be explained by the weight loss alone. And so that's what these studies have been finding. Like, just because the patients are losing weight, there's also all these additional benefits to their overall health, hopefully that will follow them through the rest of their life. And so after adjusting even for the weight reduction in patients, the cardiovascular benefits continue to persist. So it gives a anti-inflammatory suggestion for the patient. It decreases vascular and metabolic concerns. And then also, like I said, may even have direct cardiac benefits to the patient as well. And so what and how can, you know, we move through and work through these things. So the first major shift for this really came when the cardiovascular outcomes were noted in patients who were having type 2 diabetes, but also seeing improvement. And so that's really how and why, in addition to the weight loss that was happening, was continued to be studied for the patient. And so we're really kind of witnessing this evolution of a whole new therapeutic class for patients overall. These are not just multiple medications that a patient will continually be on, but it might just be the use of something that's an injectable or a once daily pill that they can take that can have an entire benefit to their overall body system. And so that's just something that we really haven't seen up to this point. So really also thinking about that obesity management, it hasn't become just aspirational or something that seems like it has to be just specifically cosmetic, but it's really truly is providing you overall health benefits for you and your family and your children. So these GLP-1 therapies, like I said, are no longer confined now to just diabetic management or patients who are wanting to lose weight, but we can also now extend them into patients who have chronic kidney disease, heart failure, if they're having functional capacity issues, and then, of course, impacting their quality of life. And so this is just really growing and is showing reflection and recognition on how this can improve the, your overall body systems for the patient. So thinking about that and knowing the implications that it has, right? We continue to go back and talk about how there's weight loss with the patient. We have to think about how can we preserve that lean body mass with the patient as they're losing weight. And so we know at any point in time when somebody loses weight, you do lose a little bit of lean muscle mass, even if you're losing fat. And so we've kind of come up with how can we structure or what would those recommendations be for the patient. We have seen anywhere, and this is going to sound crazy, but studies show that they have seen anywhere from 20 to 50% of total weight loss for a patient with the use of these medications. Yes. And I don't know where the 50%, like how long they have been on it to achieve that. But for some of these specifically, I'll get a little bit into at, you know, a point within a year, we typically see upwards of 22 to 25% with a specific medication. And that's after being on it for 12 months. So you're really going from one person, you know, within a year to a completely different person, all things considered.
Now, so is that the typical recommendation for someone to be on a GLP-1 for 12 months, or is it longer? Is it something that they would stay on for life?
Right. Or so up to, I would say probably even up to this most recent year, the recommendation was using it like a weight loss tool that we've had in the past. So those you typically are more so considered short intermittent spurts. So 3 months here or 6 months here. And then you take a time off and you may reconsider going back on it. But in general, with these medications specifically, they would say max the patient out however long that takes. And so it's a slow onboarding process. Typically, you don't start to increase anymore. The recommendation is not to increase until they've plateaued. So even if they're at an introductory dose, but they're seeing results, then keep them at that until their weight starts to plateau and then go up. And then you just kind of keep doing that until they see a plateau. A lot of patients after 12 months, research has shown, will plateau in general. And then that's where you can have a conversation with them about a maintenance or what they would like to do from there. I think the biggest takeaway is that the goal is maintenance, and not really a discontinuation. And that can be very difficult sometimes. But if we're starting to think of using these just like we would, you know, a statin or a blood pressure medication, we typically are on them indefinitely, mm-hmm. Unless you've had a major change which right. is usually weight related, and then you can consider coming off the medications, and we monitor, and then you may have to go back on. So that's why we really need to start encouraging patients, if this is a tool that they want to use or a medication or within to their regimen, implementing how can we best preserve then and make this a long-term success for them, whether their goal is to eventually come off of it or not. And so one of those things is being, how can we preserve their lean muscle mass, because we know that our muscle in general provides our metabolic support, right? It's going to help us be active, but also it helps us burn calories, and the more muscle mass you have on board is going to help you have a better rate of burning off what you do ingest for the day, give or take, right? So if we can preserve the lean muscle mass for these patients, that's really one of the best ways to help them stay in a good place as they continue to decide how to manage their health and what they decide to do, but also allow them to grow old, essentially, mm-hmm. because that's where the risk is. If you start to lose your muscle mass, or you're leaching from your bones because you're not getting those nutrients that you need, then now we're put our patients at risk for sarcopenia and osteoporosis, which is the two biggest concerns with the use of these medications. And, you know, they did not tread on that lightly either at this conference. That was a primary discussion that we had, was, okay, so how can we prevent or best prevent our patients from developing these issues? Because we would like to see them be able to grow into their 80s, you know, and not have to be worried about a fracture or the inability to have an active lifestyle, right? So thinking about the priorities and the primary things that we would then encourage patients to start to consider would be, if you want to be on these medications or find them to be beneficial for you, you really need to focus heavily on fluid intake. So 2 to 3 liters a day, that equates to about 100 ounces of water, which is, I was pleasantly surprised by that, considering that we're talking about patients who may have heart failure. And so that would be something I would very well correlate a conversation with your cardiologist if this is something you do choose to be on. But this was Mayo's guidelines, and their mm-hmm. recommendations was 2 to 3 liters of fluid a day. And then obviously limiting your sugar intake or sugar sweet beverages, and then alcohol, right? Also thinking about a calorie consumption. So what would be the minimal amount of calories that we would want a woman ingesting? 12 to 1500 a day for women, and for men, 15 to 1800, which women, I wasn't as surprised by that, but men, that definitely surprised me. I felt like that was quite under
low.
Yeah, yes. For them. And then really thinking and focusing on like a Mediterranean plant-based DASH diet would be where we would want to see your sources of food coming from. And then fiber was a huge conversation. So making sure women are hitting that 21 to 25 grams a day. Men is 30 to 38, which that surprised me as well. I did not realize they needed to consume exponentially more of fiber. Yes.
Yeah.
And just personally speaking, it's difficult to get in.
Yes.
21 to 25 a day. And I think I eat a fairly clean whole foods diet. So yeah, that definitely surprised me. You're going to be eating a lot of blueberries, and you know, you may even have to consider, you know, taking a little bit of a fiber supplement, I would assume. Chia seeds, I mean, once again, they're calorically dense. So if your goal is 15 to 1800 as a male, and you're giving up 130 for 2 tablespoons of chia seeds, I mean, that's, I don't know. I just feel like that's a prime real estate there.
Mm-hmm.
So really focusing on your whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and then protein. So that was interesting. You know, they really just said at minimum 60 to 75 grams a day is what's recommended. Or you could try and get a target of 1.5 grams per kilogram of body weight a day. I tend to tell patients, I would prefer, like, let's find out what your target weight is and then do 1 gram of protein per target weight per pound. So if a woman's target weight was, say, 160, especially if they are postmenopausal, because we know that postmenopausal women need a higher amount of protein than non, then I would say, okay, you could safely consume 160 grams of protein a day, which is also a lot.
A lot. I know. I hear that and I think, how?
Yes, yes. So start small. Maybe you'll never truly hit that target, right? But if you could even just consider doing 30 grams of protein at minimum for every meal, that would be 90 for the day and set you up for success. Yes. In general. Our goal in general should be, how can we manage the weight loss? We do not want it to come off as drastically as we may have seen with prior patients, or that you may have seen, you know, just with your friends or family, if they've had any experience with the use of these medications. Really no more than 1 to 2 pounds per week. If you start to lose more than that, that's where you start to see issues with hair loss, visible skin changes, and some of those things are not reversible. And then, you know, you're doing something to better your overall health. But then if you don't feel like you look good, or you don't feel good in your skin, mm-hmm. then that makes it even more difficult, mm-hmm. right? Really, the caveats, making sure you're getting an adequate fluid intake, because that is going to reduce some of the side effects that you can have from these medications, but also making sure you're hitting your protein to help preserve that lean muscle mass, the fiber to keep the bowel movements mm-hmm. Going and keeping things moving for you, and then also being sure that you're tacking on that resistance training so that we're preserving the lean muscle mass that is there. And then trying to hit that target of 150 to 300 minutes of physical activity a week. So what would be some of the adverse side effects of taking these medications outside of the potential for hair loss? Unfortunately, we tend to see issues with a little bit of nausea. Patients have even reported vomiting. There's also issues around, you know, constipation, diarrhea. And some patients at first find it off-putting that they feel satisfied too quickly after eating. So outside of the side effects of the medication, another typical concern is going to be cost, right? And I feel like we're just inundated with ads all the time about these outlying ones. You can order compounded ones through versus, you know, if you go to your provider. And so just a little key piece about that. Yes, you can get them from some compounding pharmacies. I would discourage it because there are also people out there who are doing studies or educational institutions, and they've tested some of these and found that there's nothing in there of that said medication. And so then you're just paying and who knows what you're injecting yourself with. You know, Eli Lilly is really the biggest pharmaceutical, or Nora Nordis is the other. And so if you want those, generally they have some type of a pharmacy plan that you can visit with your provider about, and they usually will ship it right to your house. Is there a cost for the premium? Yeah, there is. I mean, we're talking out of pocket at least $400 probably a month for these medications for now. But there are some things that your provider can do to kind of work through maybe some of that red tape. You know, the goal is if we're seeing better ways of tracking the benefit of these medications, then hopefully we can get that cost down and get insurance companies to start covering it. I know Medicare is doing a much better job now of covering some of these for their patients as well. So it, once again, it's just a conversation to have with your provider and, you know, and then go from there. All things considered, the benefit of these medications in general, like I said, we're seeing an upwards loss of anywhere from 20 to 50% weight loss in the patient. And so when compared to bariatric surgery, these are actually comparable to what we see with patients who have had bariatric surgery. And so to be able to take a pill or have an injection, have lifestyle outcomes and overall health outcomes that can be comparable to undergoing surgical intervention, you know, it's kind of like, so maybe you're paying a little more upfront, I guess, or on a monthly basis versus what you would be paying for, you know, a surgical, you know, what your surgery is going to cost.
Jade, thank you so much for providing such great information and helping people understand that world. GLP-1s, we hear a lot about them. We know they have some benefit, but I think there have been some questions, some concerns of what that does look like long-term. And so very helpful to just put some context around that. So thank you so much
for
being on the program. Jade is available. She does see patients in our clinic in Webster City. You can call Van Dees Family Health Clinic at 515-832-7800. And she also supervises and directs our skilled care program at the hospital and does a terrific job. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. And that will do it for today's edition of Focus on Health, brought to you by Van Dees Medical Center, where our focus is you.